Our next case is number 21-12024, United States versus Michael Meyer. Okay, Mr. Volrath.
Good morning, Your Honors. Derek Volrath here for appellant Michael Meyer. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and may it please the court. This appeal presents a single issue concerning the interpretation of the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, and whether it bars courts from entertaining motions to enforce the court's discovery rules against the IRS. The district court below held that the act does impose such a bar, essentially immunizing the IRS from an opposing party's efforts to police discovery abuse.
I actually think it raises another issue that I'd like to talk about at least a little bit, that I think is raised in the government's brief and that you all talk about some, and that is not the Tax Injunction Act, but whether there's jurisdiction after judgment, final judgment has been entered. In other words, what authority does a court have to act in general, forget the Tax Injunction Act for a moment, in ruling on matters after final judgment, everything's been done in a case? Can we talk about that for a second?
Of course, Your Honor. Right. And I think I would preliminarily note that that was not the basis for the district court's
ruling. I agree
ruling,
with you.
Although I don't.
I agree with you, it wasn't the basis for the district court's ruling. It does go to our jurisdiction, and it certainly was briefed by the parties here.
Correct.
You're right, the district court ruled on the Tax Injunction Act.
Certainly, and the government, for its proposition, relies on the 11th Circuit case of Absolute Activist. And that case is distinguishable from ours in an important way. Specifically, Absolute Activist held that a district court did not have jurisdiction after the closure of a case to go back and revisit a stipulated protective order between the parties to reduce the protections that that order permitted. It did not say that a district court lacks jurisdiction to enforce an existing limitation on the use to which discovery.
So, please go ahead.
Well, I guess my question is, with regard to that, where exactly is there something referenced in the protective order or even in the final judgment that the trial court entered saying that any discovery that was used would be prohibited from being used in any other proceedings?
Certainly. It's not in an order. It is in the text of Rule 36B.
No, I understand that, counsel, but normally when you are litigating a case and you're stipulating to a dismissal, you include in your joint motion for dismissal everything that the parties are agreeing to. So for instance, if you have a case involving an employment discrimination lawsuit, and the employee handbook, which is confidential, has been disseminated, there would be something entered in there saying that this will not be used in any other proceedings, and if it is, it will be a violation of a protective order, and the district court judge can go back and issue any and all sanctions, okay? So the parties have the right to include in there anything that they want to. I understand that Rule 36 says that you can't use this in any other proceeding, but there isn't anything specifically giving the district court judge jurisdiction to come back and look at it based on the order that was entered. Is that correct?
I would disagree with that because it is baked into the cake of the federal rules. Unlike the hypothetical that you offered, there is this direction in the federal rules that an admission under Rule 36B is not an admission for any other purpose and cannot be used against the party in any other proceeding.
But that's not
to ask the court.
But the problem is, counsel, that that's not an extension of jurisdiction. So the general rule we all agree is final judgment's entered, court doesn't have jurisdiction. Occasionally it reserves ruling on some things and it reserves for that. Now there are some exceptions that are out there. And the one that I think applies or is closest to here and the one I want to talk about is the Cooter and Gell exception. That's the Supreme Court case that dealt with collateral matters. And what it seems to suggest there is where a proceeding is a separate in nature and independent proceeding from the merits, the court does have jurisdiction to rule on those collateral matters. The examples it gave there and that y'all talk about are sanctions, attorney's fees, costs, because those are truly separate and independent matters that could themselves be filed and that don't underlie the merits here. So applying that exception, which I think is the one that governs here, I'm having trouble seeing how a discovery matter in that underlies the case is equivalent to or like those separate things that are truly separate and independent proceedings as we understand them, like sanctions or attorney's fees.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor, and I would point to the language in Absolute Activist that I think draws from that Cooter decision that says that a court retains jurisdiction over issues that implicate the power, and this is the quoted language, implicate the power to enforce compliance with the rules and standards that keep the judiciary running smoothly. And that this Rule 36B falls within that language.
So you raised this in your gray brief, and it's something I've thought a lot about. And that is, if you had raised this as a sanctions motion rather than as what you raised it as, would that result be different? And I have to tell you that I think the answer is clearly yes, that you would, if this was raised as a sanctions, be allowed to be here. But raising it as the enforcement of something that is already done seems to be not collateral, but very much within the heart of the merits of the underlying action.
Yeah, we were presented with a difficult choice, I think, of how to frame this issue in the district court below. One of the things that we could have done, I think we could have moved for contempt sanctions, and we could have tried to find the IRS as the litigant or the DOJ attorney as the counsel in contempt of court. We felt the better course was to obtain clarity from the court that this use of these admissions was prohibited by the rule, and believing that in the face of a clear order like that, the government would recognize its duty to follow those orders and do it.
The problem is, though, the way that it's framed, and you're right that these are difficult choices litigation-wise. I mean, no one can begrudge anyone for making the litigation choices you have to make, but by going this road, what we're essentially being asked to do is to litigate a discovery sanction, which is something that, again, that seems to be not collateral like would be for an independent sanction for violating rules, but an enforcement of a discovery mechanism that would happen during the course of trial. It just doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that Cooter and Gell have carved out.
Yeah, I would disagree, Your Honor. I think that if we had an order, as Judge Lagoa observed, stating, by the way, under Rule 36, admission shall be used only for the purpose of this litigation and for no other purpose, this would be a slam dunk. Like, this issue wouldn't be on the table. And it seems bizarre, respectfully, to require the court to enter an order that's simply duplicative of an instruction that's already within the rules.
Did the government assert the lack of power argument in the district court that it's making here? It certainly argued that the Tax Injunction Act barred the relief you sought, and it argued that even if it didn't, the federal rules of civil procedure didn't apply to those IRS tax assessment proceedings. But did it make the argument that it's making initially in its brief now, that the district court would have had no power, no authority to grant you the relief because the case was closed?
Your Honor, it certainly didn't cite Absolute Activist, and it didn't cite this principle that a court loses power to adjudicate a matter under Rule 26C.
See, from my perspective, I wouldn't reach that issue, because although it might affect the district court's jurisdiction, should it decide to go down that road, that's not an issue that was raised below. It doesn't affect our appellate jurisdiction here, and I would let the district court figure that out, almost analogous to what we talked about in the earlier case before yours, and then let that issue come up as it may. But the district court ruled only on the Tax Injunction Act, and I would decide that issue, whether it's favorable to you or adverse to you, and move on from there.
I certainly agree with that approach. I think it is important to have the district court address this issue in the first instance, even if, and your honors are going to read the orders or the motions and determine whether the issue is raised. I will point out that there's a procedural wrinkle here in that there was a reference to the magistrate judge for report and recommendation, and the report and recommendation came out, and then there was briefing before the district judge. In the report and recommendation addressed only the Tax Anti-Injunction Act. And so that was the only issue briefed before the district judge. There were no cross-objections from the government about reaching the absolute activist issue. There are no further questions. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Hauser.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, counsel, I'll start you off. The two issues I'd like to be addressed are the one that Judge Jordan just ended with, which is, did the government raise this either in its response to the motion for protective order or in its objections to the R&R? I've read them, and it seems to me no, it didn't make this argument.
Yes.
So address that, and does that matter, and is this something that we should not address for the reasons Judge Jordan did, or does it go to our jurisdiction such that we should? And then the second question for me is, and this goes to the merits here, is that the Anti-Injunction Act seems to be related to suits, right? Is this a suit as understood in 1867 when this was first enacted?
The answer to the first question, as you've already suggested, Your Honor, is no, we did not brief the absolute activist issue in the district court. I believe you can reach it on appeal, just as this court reached it in the absolute activist case, because if there is no jurisdiction for the lower court to issue its order, then to issue the order that was sought, then
the district court would have had power to deny?
Power to deny relief, yes.
If the district court on the merits had said, your motion is denied, Mr. Meyer, for these three reasons, would it have had jurisdiction to do that? You're saying it wouldn't have had jurisdiction to even entertain it. You see the difference? The conceptual difference?
Yes.
So you're saying what you should have done was move to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction on that ground. Mm-hmm. If you're right, the district court couldn't even have entertained it, except to say I have no jurisdiction. But it couldn't have denied it on the merits, right?
I think you're right, Your Honor, yes.
So your argument is that it's not just jurisdiction to grant relief, it's jurisdiction to entertain, right?
Yes.
No, it's your argument, not mine.
My argument is simply that there's the...
Let's assume you had preserved everything.
Right, okay.
What's the district court supposed to do? Your first argument is you have no jurisdiction to grant any relief because the case is closed.
Right.
You haven't reserved jurisdiction, X, Y, and Z. This is not a contempt proceeding. It's not a sanctions proceeding. Cooter and Gell and those types of cases don't apply. You can't do this. Number two, even if you could, Tax Anti-Injunction Act, and even if that doesn't bar you, then the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure don't apply to a tax assessment proceeding by the IRS.
Yes.
If the district court goes down that tree of decision-making, mm-hmm. what should it have done at step one?
It should have dismissed the motion because it's a new motion in a closed proceeding. And it doesn't have any of the collateral forms of jurisdiction here.
Yeah, see, that's why I think that's right. I think that's the effect.
Yes.
And so I don't think we need to, I'm not saying as a discretionary matter we can't. I'm just saying I don't think we need to discuss that issue because the district court didn't figure out whether it was going down that road or not. It denied relief, not on the merits, but because of the application of the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, right?
And it was correct to do so, Your Honor, yes. Once it reached the issue of the Anti-Injunction Act, it was correct.
Right, so let's talk about Judge Luck's question.
Yes.
And it's not just a question of I'll add something to his if he lets me.
Well, if you answer mine, and then you can answer whatever.
if I recall correctly, Judge Luck, your question was, is this a suit, would this motion in a closed proceeding have been a suit in 1867? Is that right. Correct? And my answer is yes, it would have been a new suit.
What authority do you have for that? What authority do you have for that proposition? You certainly say it in your brief.
I do.
There was normally after a proposition like that, there's something called C, and then there's some something else. I've gone into the trouble of looking, but I want to know what authority you have for the proposition.
I believe we cited a history of injunction motions in our brief, Your Honor. There are few cases addressing it because such post hoc motions were not procedurally common at the time.
I've looked at the relevant legal dictionaries from the time. There aren't mm-hmm. many, but Bouvet's seems to be the prevailing one. The Blacks didn't publish until the 1890s. And in Bouvet's, they seem to suggest that, quote, a suit, and they defined it based on the Judiciary Act of 1789. That was what they were looking at as sort of defining what mm-hmm. suit is. The word suit in that act applies to any proceeding in a court of justice in which the plaintiff pursues in such court the remedy which law affords him. Obviously, that'd be her today, too. So plaintiff, Mr. Meyer is not a plaintiff. He was the defense in this case, so that would not seem to apply. And this doesn't seem to be the remedy which law affords, meaning that you're not seeking a remedy based on it that you would if you were filing a separate case. So it seems to me to not apply. If we look at what it meant there. Now, I think Judge Jordan's going to ask you what it means now, or fast forward a little bit, but at least then it would seem not to apply, right?
At the time the Anti-Injunction Act was enacted, the act was sufficient to cut back on the injunction suits that were then flooding the district courts. So from this, I infer that there was no substantial number of such post hoc motions, but I could not.
But the injunction suits would be actions that were commenced, initiated,
right,
by a plaintiff, as opposed to the government using it as a sword.
That's right. And that's what the Seventh Circuit said in the Dima case, Your Honor. It said that this kind of motion in a pending case, DEMA was a case that was active at the time, is a sort of countersuit within the suit, it's not just a motion within the regular suit. It is a new claim for an injunction. And that's what it was here. There was no suit. The suit was closed. And so this is a new effort by Mr. Meyer coming into court to revive a proceeding where none was pending.
Now, the definition today is largely the same as Judge Luck. It's not exactly the same, but it's close. So today the definition of suit is any proceeding by a party or parties against another in a court of law for relief. And that's the current edition of Black's Law Dictionary. So I don't think it's changed all that much in over a century. But let me give you a hypothetical.
All right.
And tell me how you think it plays out. Okay. You had the suit against Mr. Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
You served the request for admissions on him. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He answers the same way he did this time around. But before that case ends, the IRS begins tax assessment proceedings, and they send them a note of assessment before the case is over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Same exact thing you've done now, except it's pre-judgment.
Yes.
He moves in the district court for a protective order.
Mm-hmm.
What does the district court do?
Follows DEMA. That's the same situation as the DEMA case in the Seventh Circuit.
You're telling me that there's and the result is what?
The result is that there's no jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is stripped by the Anti-Injunction Act. Or
even in a suit that you brought against him?
Because he is seeking to prevent some other thing from happening outside of the suit. This is...
But in that case, I don't see how... That's even further away from the definitions that Judge Luck and I have told you about, that he's not instituting anything.
It's also, by the way, bad for your jurisdiction argument because that means it's completely collateral. And it does fall within the Cooter and Gell exception. If it's not related to exactly the suit that's existing in, under the hypothetical there, then it is a completely collateral matter in which it would very much be like sanctions and other things, in which case there would absolutely be subject matter jurisdiction.
Almost like a little stalactite litigation that happens outside of the guts of the first lawsuit. You think that if the IRS had moved to impose the assessments based on the request for admission before judgment, during the litigation, he could not have moved for a protective order under Rule 36B. That would have been prohibited.
The IRS has not issued an assessment in this case. This is
proposed.
There was a proposed assessment.
Same thing, okay. Forget my language.
It
did the exact same thing that it's done here, except it did it pre-judgment. He moves for a protective order.
There is an entire procedure created by Congress for judicial review of the assessments.
That doesn't mean that it's exclusive. My point is, or my question is, what does the district court have the authority to do if everything here had happened pre-judgment?
If it had happened pre-judgment?
Yes. Everything else is the same, except that the IRS did what it did before you reached judgment in the district court case that you filed and before that case was closed.
And they used the request for admission
to do
that was propounded under Rule 36,
mm-hmm.
where Mr. Meyer admits,
right.
Okay, and you use his request for admissions, as you did, in order to do your pre-assessment.
He has no relief under Rule
in that case,
36 in that case.
Rule 36 talks about a pending case, so that would...
It does not. It says an admission under this rule is not an
admission
for any other purpose and cannot be used against the party in any other proceeding.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Is it Rule 26, which is the protective motion, not Rule 30?
Okay, but here...
Right.
The rule that we're proceeding under...
Yes.
And you need to answer Judge Jordan's question, which is Rule 36. You propound request for admissions under Rule 36. Mr. Meyer responds, and he provides you answers to these requests for admissions. You concede that you are not allowed to use those admissions in any other proceeding, correct?
We would then have to reach the third step of the decision tree that
agree,
Judge Jordan...
Do you concede that you are not allowed to use those requests for admissions, those answers, in any other proceeding?
We argued in the district court, Your Honor, that the IRS examinations are not proceedings within the meaning of...
Okay, so your response is that the government has no obligation and you can do whatever you want. That's your answer, correct?
The government will be required... If the government assesses, which it has not yet done... The government will have the obligation of proving these assessments in a district court proceeding,
a de novo district court proceeding. If any party, Party A, does a request for admission to Party B and Party B admits it, Party A then can use those responses in any other proceeding?
No, not in a proceeding, Your Honor. In an administrative...
What do you think... I mean, a proceeding is... So I've done a little bit of dictionary hunting myself, although I'll be the first to admit that I haven't been as thorough as Judge Luck was. But proceeding today,
mm-hmm.
is more contemporary because the rules of civil procedure are more contemporary, right? A proceeding is, I'll give you two definitions, any procedural means for seeking redress from a tribunal or agency. Mm-hmm. That's one. And another one is the business conducted by a court or other official body.
But the IRS examination is not a procedure for seeking redress from the IRS. It's the IRS's decision-making process.
So it is the business conducted by a court or other official body. That's the other alternative definition.
I'm not going to dispute that the IRS is some kind of official body. But the IRS believes it has the right to use this. It argued it below. The district court did not reach it. That's the government's decision.
But your opposition, I think the way you explained it was that you thought that this was not a proceeding, not that Rule 36 wouldn't have provided a basis for relief had all this occurred pre-judgment, right? It's not that the district court couldn't have looked at Rule 36. You're just saying that the way Rule 36 operates, it wouldn't have provided him for it wouldn't have provided relief for him.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I think I understand. So if now let's give another hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
Government imposes the tax assessment, right, and institutes an affirmative cause of action against him to, let's say, well, to collect.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Can you use the admissions in that case?
No.
If you do, what is his recourse?
He's in a district court case. He's a defendant in the district court case. He can put the government to its burden of proof.
No, no. He is. But your burden of proof is you're like, here is admissions.
Oh, no, no. Because the
but you do,
because
but
that's a proceeding.
No, no. In my hypothetical,
okay,
the government hasn't behaved as charitably as you've described. So the lawyer who's litigating on behalf of the IRS, when he says, prove it, the government's first exhibit is, here are your admissions from case number one. What is his recourse in case number two?
He could move, the same as he would have to any evidentiary, with any evidentiary objection. He could move to exclude them.
You would move, the question is, would he move in litigation one, or would he move in litigation?
Oh, he would move in litigation two, yes, not in litigation one.
And that second court would have the authority to trigger Rule 36B protections?
Yes.
That were provided in a closed case?
Yes. Because Rule 36 is a rule. It's a standing rule. It's different from a rule that's issued in a particular case where the court might have particular knowledge and familiarity with the circumstance.
So putting aside the Tax Injunction Act, and putting, these are big things that I'm putting aside, but
yes,
and putting aside the question that Judge Luck posed to you at the very beginning and to Mr. Volrath about the district court's own jurisdiction, if this is a proceeding, then Rule 36 applies, right?
If putting aside the Anti-Injunction Act?
Yes, on the
yes,
merits. On the
yes,
merits.
If you put aside the Anti-Injunction Act and you put aside all the jurisdictional
merits,
yes,
discussion,
yes,
it applies.
Yes, because this court proceeding is a proceeding. Yes.
But the IRS administrative pre-assessment thing is not a proceeding.
That's right. And it is not governed by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, as the Fifth Circuit held back in, I believe, 1961. And the reason that that position has survived for all these years, and there's many, many cases cited in our brief, is because the IRS's decisions are subject to de novo review in the district courts. With the taxpayers can put the government to its proof, and evidence can be excluded in that case. So courts don't, otherwise you could have a situation where taxpayers try to intervene in the middle of IRS examinations all the time, and the IRS, the courts push all of those questions until the IRS examination is concluded, and then the entire issue is reviewed subject to de novo review, which provides, in this case, it would be de novo review with the government bearing the burden of proof. And so that provides the taxpayer all the protection they could want against the government using inappropriate information.
The problem for me on the tax injunction side, and that's where I'm at, is there's a difference between intervening in something to stop it, meaning they're seeking affirmative relief from a court to stop it ongoing, which is exactly the sort of reason why the Tax Anti-Injunction Act was passed, versus this sort of proceeding, or this sort of motion, which seems to me very different. And that's why I think the definition of suit is important, and why I think it is the gateway between being allowed to use the Anti-Injunction Act and not being able to use it.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would just point you to the language in DEMA where they look at the net effect of the particular motion that was at issue in that case to determine whether it's...
I've never been in love with spirits as opposed to language, but I understand.
But they do look at the effect of the motion to determine whether it is, and I would reiterate that the Supreme Court in CIC Services very recently looked to the question of what is the effect of this motion in determining whether the Anti-Injunction Act applied. I see that I've gone past my time, and I would like to ask the court to affirm the order of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hauser. So, Mr. Volrath, why isn't the answer to all this quagmire that you can raise your Rule 36B argument if and when the IRS goes after your client for an assessment?
Well, I think there are two responses to that. And the first is that the existence of one sort of avenue of one approach doesn't necessarily preclude the existence of another approach. Just the fact that there's this.
I agree with that.
But then, second, refund suits are not easy. You have to pay the tax, or the IRS subjects you to collections efforts in order to recover the tax assessed. And then only once that's paid can you go to the district court and seek a refund. So it's not quite the easy remedy that that the government sort of has taken the position that it is. So I think those are the two answers to that question. I did want to make some additional points on rebuttal. The first is I think that your honors have gotten a sense of sort of the extreme position that DOJ and or the government and the IRS takes concerning the Anti-Injunction Act. And I think that the IRS and, frankly, taxpayers can use the guidance on what the Tax Anti-Injunction Act applies to. And for that reason, I would encourage your honors to reach that issue to the extent you have discretion to do so. Second, I wanted to briefly revisit briefly touch upon the meaning of suit and when the court considers looks at the definition of that term suit. I wanted to observe that the Tax Anti-Injunction Act has been recodified along with the rest of the Internal Revenue Code several times. When it was initially enacted, the discovery rules were not in existence. There wasn't liberal discovery like there is now. And as the act has been recodified after the rules, if Congress wanted to address that and wanted to include discovery motions within that language suits, it certainly could have done so. I would also point to the precatory language a little bit in the first clause of the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, which actually refers to several different subsections of the code and suits that are authorized. Those are all suits for injunctions brought by taxpayers against the IRS. And that kind of sheds some light on the meaning of that term suit. So as you try to parse that language and figure out what that means, that might be useful to consider. Third, I want to briefly address CIC Services, which is a very recent Supreme Court decision that addressed the Tax Anti-Injunction Act. The only thing I want to point out about that is that that was a taxpayer suit brought for the to challenge an IRS notice requirement, a reporting requirement. The Supreme Court held that that was not barred by the Anti-Injunction Act, but it doesn't really speak directly to the issues that we're talking about.
Well, more today. To a policy, though. I mean, that's why it was carved out. It didn't go to a direct case where they were seeking or proposing to seek any sort of penalty or assessment.
Right? That's true. Right.
That's really what makes that different, I think.
That's true. Finally, I do want to address DEMA. And as Your Honor, Judge Luck observed, that was based on the sort of non-textual reading of looking to the spirit and the purpose behind the...
Well, let me get you... I said what I said, but let me get you to give you the counter-argument. And that is that at least some of our older Fifth Circuit cases have seemed to rely on that general rationale on very factually different cases. Chemlon Products and Campbell, for example, cited by the party, seem to and rely on DEMA and this sort of broader approach to what I'll call a purposivist approach that the government is advocating here.
Well, I acknowledge that, and
do you agree that those cases seem to stand for that proposition?
So I agree that they stand for that proposition in very factually different cases. For example, in DEMA specifically, that began as an IRS summons enforcement action for one set of records, actually I think it was two sets of records, business and personal, for 1 year. The taxpayer prevailed on his argument to quash the summons for his personal records for that 1 year. And then after the case was closed and dismissed, the IRS served a notice of assessment on the taxpayer personally for that year. The taxpayer, for reasons I don't quite understand, moved for a contempt order holding the IRS in contempt. The district court, again, for reasons that aren't totally apparent from the text of DEMA, found that the IRS's actions bordered on harassment, so not necessarily harassment, but very close, and then issued this sweeping injunctive relief and said, you may not request any information from the taxpayer, not only for the year at issue in this case, but for every year prior. And that's just a totally different situation from the one we have here. I would point out that the DEMA court was troubled and observed that, made that clear in its opinion about that statutory that argument based on the statutory language, that this wasn't a taxpayer suit, and then confined its ruling to the unique circumstances of that case. And I think that is when the Fifth Circuit has done that, it's followed in that same vein. I do also think that the Wearson case is correct about how best to get at congressional intent is by looking at the languages of the statute. And obviously, I'm running out of time, so I will not rehash all the reasons that's a good idea.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Volra, thank you very much. Ms. Hauser,
thank you
very much as well.
Thank you both.